So yesterday we started with our first mitzvah, which was the mitzvah to inhabit the sukkah, right? And we said that a katan, someone who's a minor, right, is actually obligated to inhabit the sukkah. Seems like just the way an adult would be required. From the point where they don't need their mother anymore, then we had like a brief conversation in the Talmud, like what kind of need are we talking about? Are we talking about a physical need? Or are we talking about more of like an emotional need? We ended up saying, we're actually going to go by the slightly older standard, which is more emotional independence. And the, you know, rabbis end up saying that that's like 5 or 6. And we also had the, you know, beautiful example and also challenging example, right, of Shammai Hazaken, Shammai the elder, who is deciding that he needs to alter the house that his daughter-in-law is living in, right, so that the baby, right, who is definitely tzarich li'imo, definitely still needs their mother, so that the baby will be able to inhabit the sukkah. And we talked a little bit about, you know, the way that Shammai Hazaken sort of really seems to be taking seriously wanting children to participate, and the way that having a higher standard for children to participate, both in terms of age, right, and just in terms of how seriously we're going to take this obligation, that ends up being a, I don't want to say burden, but that ends up being a responsibility, right, for the parents. That even if you never say explicitly, right, the parents are going to have to get involved. Once you use the language of obligated for someone who is 5 years old, right, it stands to reason that that is going to impact the lives of the adults that are still responsible for that kid. And, you know, the image of somebody washing their hand on Yom Kippur, which is generally not allowed, or physically altering the structure of the house where they live all the time, right, in order to accommodate the needs of this child, I think was like a very strong manifestation of the significance and the way that it filters out. We saw that the Rambam, right, when the Rambam saw that the rabbis sort of characterized this obligation later, right, in the Talmud, not in the Mishnah, but later in the Talmud, they characterized this obligation as being rabbinic in nature. Okay, for the Rambam, right, what that signified to him was, it's an obligation on the parents to educate the child in this mitzvah from that point. And we were very clear, right? And we're going to be even more clear today that that is not the plain sense of what's happening in the Mishnah and in the Gemara, right? The plain sense of what is happening in the Mishnah and the Gemara is the child is obligated. That ends up having an impact on the parents. Not the parents are obligated to educate, and now's the time, right, that responsibility is going to devolve onto a child. Okay, so that's where we were last session. In this session, we're going to move to a different mitzvah. We're going to move to different standards of when a child is obligated, and we're going to go further into this conversation about what is the relationship that the adults have, right, to the responsibilities that we are now saying that the children have. Okay. In the next mitzvah, we are in the mitzvah of lulav. Katan hayodea lena'anea chayav balulav. A minor who knows how to wave is obligated in taking a lulav. Okay, now we don't mean like the way that a six-month-old will wave with their hand, hello, right? We're talking more about maybe like a three-year-old who you could say, pick up this object, you know, shake it to the front, shake it to the side, shake it to the back. It could even be more simple, just a child that has the dexterity to actually pick up a lulav, which would be very, very young. Okay, but at the very least, it seems like this standard of knowing how to pick up and shake a lulav is actually young, right? It seems to be significantly younger than a no tzarich li'imo, right? The child doesn't need to be independent in any way. They just need to have the gross motor skills, right, to be able to wave the lulav. And again, the language of chayav, the language of obligated, is not at all modified, right? It's not obligated rabbinically. It's not obligated in the sense that they need to start learning. It actually seems that the plain sense here is obligated with a capital O. And then the Gemara is going to bring up Raita, which those of you who are fans of Responsa Radio might have recently heard quoted in the episode where Rav Eitan and Rav Avi were talking about bar and bat mitzvah age. Anyway, it's a good episode. You should listen to it. And if you haven't listened to that episode yet, great. This text will probably be new to you. But the Gemara is going to bring a braita, right? Bring another rabbinic Tanaitic teaching. There are different versions of this braita sort of floating around. But this braita is going to be giving us different standards for the mitzvot, for different mitzvot, where the child is going to be obligated. Okay? And we are going to see, I think, through this braita, how seriously we're using the language of obligated. Okay. It's also like a nice little tour of different mitzvot. Okay. A minor who knows how to wave is obligated in taking a lulav. We already saw that in our Mishnah, and here this other Tanaitic text, right, this contemporaneous text is saying the same thing, right? The point at which a child needs to take a lulav is the point at which they can physically manipulate the lulav appropriately, okay? And it, when the child is at the age where they can wrap themselves, right, sort of to get dressed, then they're obligated in tzitzit. If they're old enough to guard their tefillin, then the father gets them tefillin. If they know how to speak, then the father teaches them Torah and Kriyat Shema, right? So first, I just want you to notice, right, that there's a distinction here in some of these mitzvot. When we're talking about a lulav and we're talking about tzitzit, there's no father. There's no parent involved, okay? The parent only gets involved when we are talking about tefillin and Kriyat Shema. And we're going to see a text later that tries to figure out why there's this distinction, right? Between certain mitzvot where it seems like we're talking about the kid and to the kid, you are obligated in these mitzvot, and where the father is going to be also involved. Okay. And now we ask, what is Torah? Rav Hamduna said, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, morasha kilat Yaakov. This pasuk from Devarim, Moshe instructed us in the Torah, an inheritance to the assembly of Yaakov, which is both just a good example of what's a good place to start, right, when you're trying to teach your child Torah, and also gives us some sense of what the level of difficulty and sophistication is, right, that we're talking about when we're talking about teaching Torah. It's one pasuk, right, and it's a pasuk that's basically like, the Torah is ours. And I actually think it's like a very beautiful first pasuk to teach a child, right? To sort of have the child understand and feel like the Torah is theirs. Okay. And what is Kriyat Shema? When we say that they're obligated in Kriyat Shema, we mean they're obligated in the first verse, right? You need to be able to recite all three paragraphs, but the first verse is where we're going to start. Okay. The next section is the section that I actually think is in some way most important. Okay, because this next section is not actually talking about obligations of the child or obligations of the parent to educate the child, but is actually talking about how we can trust the child to sort of make ritual status decisions based on them. By which I mean, and we are now living in a time where everybody's impure, okay? There's no ashes of the red heifer, right? We're all in a state of impurity, but there was a time, right, when people actually would be completely ritually pure, and then they would be able to eat the kind of food that requires a person to be ritually pure in order to eat, okay? So like, let's say I'm a Kohen and I'm allowed to eat truma. When I eat truma, I need to be in a state of ritual purity. Okay, so now we're saying a child who knows how to guard their body, one can eat pure food on their body. Meaning, I'm a kid and I can be trusted to know where I've been, right? And to not touch things that I'm not supposed to touch. And if I then say, I haven't gone anywhere where there's impurity, so, and I touched that food, you don't have to worry, that food is still considered to be pure. Okay. And similarly, the Shemor Ad Yadav, to know where their hands have been, you can eat pure food on their hands. Okay, now the reason why this is so significant to us, even though we are not in a place where we are checking for the ritual purity of ourselves or our food, right, is that you wouldn't be able to say here, it's merely rabbinic, right? That doesn't make any sense, right? Either the food is pure and you can eat it, or it's impure and you can't eat it, okay? So the fact that we're not making a distinction here, I think, really supports the contention that we made last week, which is that when we say that they're obligated, we mean that they're obligated, not in an educational way, not in a rabbinic way, but it's just plain sense of obligated, the same way that here you wouldn't be able to say, oh, the food is pure in order to educate the kid. That doesn't make any sense, right? So we're not making a distinction here. I think that's very significant. Okay, similarly, if you have a Kohen kid who knows how to, you know, do the priestly blessing, then we can give them truma, distribute them truma in the granary. Okay, that's where often the priests, and I guess in this case, the priest kids, they go and they want to get the truma first. So they like to hang out where the grain is being processed so they can get it hot off the mill. Okay, and here's a really exciting law. One who knows how to slaughter, okay, a child who knows how to slaughter, we may eat from what they have slaughtered. And then Rav Habnuna, what I like to call the voice of reason here, says, and that is if there is an adult supervising, right? So on the one hand, sure, your eight-year-old, you know, may be able to handle a knife, and we're talking about an extremely sharp knife, okay? So we certainly want an adult to be there. And also, we're talking about possibly an extremely expensive animal, okay? You're not going to just let your eight-year-old practice, right, on a cow. You're going to make sure that there's an adult there. Okay. One who can eat a full olive's worth of grain, right, sort of the amount that's considered to be eating, not like a spoon of cereal. We distance ourselves 4 amot from their excrement and urine. Sorry for those of you for whom it's lunchtime. Okay. Then essentially, we're not supposed to daven. We're not supposed to do holy things around poopy places. Okay. But like, if you have an infant that, you know, goes every hour and they, you know, and there's a wet diaper, you don't have to worry about it. You only have to worry about the excrement and urine of someone who is like a person. Okay. Rav Chista says that when we talk about eating this amount of grain, you also have to eat it fast enough, right? So like, that's an important distinction. A toddler, maybe over the course of 2 days, is going to eat this full olive's worth of grain, but they can't eat it in a single sitting. Okay, so Rav Chista is clarifying, we're talking about eating it in a single sitting. And with an adult, even if they cannot eat it in this span of time, as it says, Yosef da'at Yosef mach'ov, one who increases in knowledge increases in pain. This is a very weird proof text to say that the excrement of an adult is considered excrement no matter how fast they eat, right? There's nothing here about eating and there's nothing here about pooping. So I will just, in a little aside, tell you that part of what's going on in the background here is that there is like a rabbinic association between eating solid foods and being an adult and eating grain and being an adult and reaching these stages and having knowledge or wisdom. And it's connected to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that the tree of knowledge, right, in the Garden of Eden was actually grain, right? It was actually a stalk of wheat. Because the point at which a child eats really solid food, can eat and process grain, that is also connected to a certain point of cognitive awareness. Okay. Anyway, this is just an aside. I thought it was interesting. We're going to keep on going. One who can eat an olive's amount of roasted meat, we include them in the count for the Korban Pesach. Okay, this is also very significant. You are not allowed to waste any part of the Pesach offering. So when we say this kid, as soon as they can eat enough, they get to be part of the count of all of the people who are sort of distributing the Korban Pesach among them, that's a really serious thing. And it is not rabbinic and it is not educational. It is practical. We need to make sure that all of this Korban is being eaten appropriately. Okay. As it says, ish lefi achlo, right, a man according to what they eat. How do we determine whether or not this is a person who is included in the Korban Pesach? Do they eat? Okay. And if they eat enough, they get to be part of it. And then Rabbi Yehuda says, I need this to be intellectual as well, not until he knows how to select food. Okay. We're not just talking about someone who can physically choke down a kazayit of meat. We're also talking about someone who can look at that and say, that is meat, right? I know that that is edible, and I know that something else is not edible, right? So not until he knows how to select food and how do we test it. You give him a rock and he's like, I don't want to eat that. That's not food. But you give him a nut and he's like, yummy, yummy, right? And he eats the nut. So even though a rock and a nut have very similar textures, right? Once you get to a certain age, you don't confuse a rock and a nut, and you know which one of them is edible and which one of them is not edible. Again, the significance of all these examples, you know, aside for obviously we need to know when we can distribute our truma to this little Kohen boy, right, is so that you can see that there does not seem to be any distinction between ritual status things, which are not subject to, oh, rabbinically it's permitted, oh, educationally it's permitted, and the kinds of obligations we were talking about in the beginning of this text, wearing a tallit, wearing your tefillin, waving your lulav. But nevertheless, if you're going to see Rashi, right, when Rashi sees chayav balulav, that the child is obligated in the lulav, that he clarifies, right? They don't really mean obligated, right? They mean obligated, that the parent or whoever is obligated to educate the child, mi divrehem, from their words, that's code for rabbinic. Okay, so it's very, very clear, right, that Rashi is changing, okay, modifying the plain meaning of this text. The plain meaning of this text is this child is truly obligated, and Rashi's like, oh, no, not really obligated from a Torah level, and also the kind of obligation that they have is merely to be educated. Okay, we could have a whole separate conversation about why later rabbinic authorities are downgrading these obligations, but it's really important for you to understand, right, that this is a choice that later rabbinic authorities are making, and it is not the way that these early Tannaitic texts are thinking about it. These early Tannaitic texts are not thinking about educating children. They're actually thinking about children functioning in these mitzvot, and essentially, there's no blanket time whenever this child is developmentally ready for any given mitzvah. That is the point at which the switch flips and they are obligated, period, right? That is the Tannaitic view. Okay. What I wanted to do with the balance of our time, which is not a tremendous amount, is to bring you two sources that talk about this notion of the requirement to educate children, okay? On whom does it devolve and like how does it work? Because we saw last week, right, when you say that a child is obligated in the sukkah and the child does not have the wherewithal to build their own sukkah, right, you're essentially also obligating the parents and the grandparents around them, okay? So I wanted to bring you this passage from Rav Melamed in the Panine Halacha. This is actually in part of his conversation about the laws of Shabbat, right? And Shabbat is definitely a place, those of you who have children, you know, hopefully remember, where it's like the beginning of where you have to sort of say to a child, you were allowed to do this yesterday, you're going to be allowed to do this tomorrow, but on Shabbat we don't, I don't know, whatever it is in your family you don't do, on Shabbat we don't use our phone. Right? I know you're used to having iPad time for half an hour. You don't have iPad time today, right? And it can be a real source of tension for children, right? Because they understand there are things I'm not allowed to do and things that I am allowed to do, but I'm not allowed to do it this day, right? Is very hard for children to understand. And so I think that's why Rav Melamed decides that he's going to have this conversation about training children in mitzvot in his larger conversation about Shabbat, because it can become such a point of tension, right, for parents trying to educate their children, because it's very hard, right? It's much easier to say, we don't eat pork and we never eat pork than, well, usually you're allowed to go to school, but today we have to go to synagogue. And usually you're allowed to, you know, I don't know, what are children going to want to do? Color with your markers, right? And on Shabbat, we don't color. Okay, so we're just going to read. According to some, the obligation of chinuch, right, the requirement to educate, devolves equally upon both parents, right, the father and the mother in his case. However, most you know, halachic authorities say that only the father is obligated, and that is objecting when they transgress negative commandments and requiring them to perform positive commandments. Basically, he's also defining what education is for children, right? Education is not, we're going to sit down and we're going to read these laws. It's, I'm going to tell you, don't do this. Yes, do that. Okay. Clearly, you know, throughout all of these texts, there's a lot of gender essentialism, which is not necessarily the way that many of us are currently living our lives. But I actually think that part of his conversation, which we're going to see where he distinguishes between the role of the parents, right? If you subtract that it always has to be the father who does this thing and it always has to be the mother who does that thing, I actually think he's saying something very profound about education, which you can learn even if you're going to strip away, right, the question of a relative role of each parent. Okay. So this is an extension of the obligation to teach them Torah, right? The reason why the father is the one who is telling them, you must do this, you cannot do that, is because he's understanding that this is actually part of teaching them Torah, right? Teaching them Torah is not, we're going to sit there and you're going to learn your alphabet. Teaching them Torah is teaching them how to live the life of a Jew. Okay. And since generally, halakhically speaking, certainly in earlier generations, we assume that it is the father who knows Torah and teaches Torah. We're actually going to complicate that in tomorrow's class. So then all of this educational responsibility is going to be the father's. Despite this, it is clear that the mother has a general mitzvah to educate her children about Torah and mitzvot. Right? But he says, education is not merely do this and don't do that. There's also a more broad type of, you know, inculcating in children the desire to be Jewish, right? The respect for mitzvot, the love of mitzvot, okay? The general commandment to love one's fellow and the demand for truth obligate every mother to educate her children to cling to the Holy Torah and observe its commandments, right? And essentially he says, yeah, if you want to read things in a very literal, halachic, formal sense, you might say if the father is obligated to teach Torah, then the father is obligated to do all of this education of the children. But actually, right, educating the children is much broader, right? To educate your children to cling to the Holy Torah and observe its commandments in a general way is also an extremely important part of a child's education. And you can't leave that out, right? Interestingly, right, he says that the way to sort of the halachic language for that is that there's a demand for truth, okay, and loving of your fellow, right? That it's basically like a mother loves their child and wants their child to succeed. And therefore, they are going to be invested in this educational project, even if there's no specific mitzvah that we can point to and say, this is the mother's obligation, okay? So what is incumbent upon the father alone, right, where it's uniquely the father's responsibility, and again, we might want to update that for our current gender norms, is the responsibility to meticulously educate about Torah and mitzvot. Right? It's very interesting, right, that he's saying that education encompasses both pieces, both the very specific, you are not allowed to do this, you are allowed to do that, you must do this, and we are invested in this larger system of Torah. And everybody in the house, right, sort of breathes that air and perpetuates that message. Okay, if there is no father present, whether due to death or absence, then the mother is obligated to teach her children meticulously about the Torah and mitzvah observance, right? And so you wouldn't just say, well, if there's no father, then the kids don't have to learn the specifics. Then the obligation then goes back to the mother. Okay. And then he gives us an example. Thus, if a child has reached the age of chinuch, which he is saying is about 6 or 7 years old, and they're involved in a game, and they don't want to come to hear kiddush or haftalah, or recite berkat hamazon, right, the grace after meals, the father must insist so as to educate the child properly. Okay? So he's like, there's one educational figure in the house that says, we're benching now, right? Everybody's coming back to the table. It's kiddush. Everybody has to be at the table. And there needs to be someone in the house that has the role of, we interrupt our game and we do what we need to do. This is an obligation and you need to listen. However, he says the mother, right? And I'm going to, again, add the context, doesn't necessarily have to be the mother, right? But there needs to also be a figure in the house who may occasionally ignore such breaches in order to maintain a pleasant atmosphere in the home, right? Actually, I think this is so important, right? If you want your children to want to be involved in Jewish life when they are no longer in your house, Jewish life cannot feel to them as always, dad banged on the table, we're not allowed to eat or drink until he makes kiddush, right? Everything is rules. There needs to be some sense in the house also of like warmth and flexibility and okay, I'll give you 5 more minutes to finish your game. And so he's dividing these roles, right? First of all, between two people, and second of all, between the father and the mother. But I will just say that I think this is an important insight. And you could even be the same parent, right, doing both, where generally the standard is, even though you're six and you don't really have a Torah obligation to hear Kiddush, we are going to set a certain expectation in our house where everybody comes to the table for Kiddush. And at the same time, your kid has a friend over and they really don't want to interrupt, you can make an exception, right? And actually making that exception is also educational because it helps them to not feel like Torah is a burden and that Jewish life is a burden. So I actually thought, you know, once you bracket the gender essentialist piece, I thought this was a very beautiful thing that he's saying about the role of the different kind of voices in education. That you need to have the strictness and you also need to have the sweetness. Okay. We are going to do a little bit more in this, and then we're going to skip to the next text. When parents neglect to educate their children and do not stop them from violating the Torah law, then the local Beit Din or public representatives who are responsible for local education should admonish the father. Okay, so essentially he imagines one scenario where there's no dad. He's absent, he's dead, God forbid, right? And then the mother has to do it. But what if you're just looking at the parents and they're letting their kids run wild and they're not at all educating them? And so then he says, it's actually the responsibility of the leaders in the community to come in and say something, okay? However, if the parents are negligent in educating their children about rabbinic obligations, then the parents do not need to get yelled at, okay? And I just thought this was very relevant because it gives us another understanding of the significance of saying that the children are obligated or the parents are obligated to educate on a rabbinic level. It might give you a sense of, right, how important is it to step in, right? And in what kinds of violations are we going to step in? Because generally, right, we don't parent other people's kids, right? We're only going to step in and say something when it's very serious. You know, and I think that probably all of us, right, we have this sense in a secular way, right, that if you are in shul, right, and somebody else's kid is, I don't know, eating too many lollipops, you would never let your kid eat that many lollipops. You are going to silently judge the parents, but you're going to keep it to yourself. Whereas if you see a kid, I don't know, God forbid, like lighting a match and they're about to, you know, set the shul on fire, you wouldn't say like, not my kid, not my problem. You would step in and you would say like, as a member of the adult community, I actually have to step in and stop this, right? And so he has that line be rabbinic versus Torah commandments. But I think, you know, it's a much more broader understanding that we're all responsible for the children in our community. And we also should know when to step in and say something and when to step back and sort of keep our mouths shut. Okay, I'm going to actually skip the end here for the sake of time. And we're going to scroll down to the next text, which is the Ben Yehoyada, who is actually a little bit earlier than the Pnei Halacha. Don't tell anybody that I did it in the wrong order. Okay. And Ben Yehoyada, he is looking at the text of that Tanaitic text that we saw, right? The Braita, where sometimes it said the child is just obligated, right? To wave a lulav, to wear a tzitzit. And sometimes it says the father gets involved, right? The father buys the tefillin or the father is going to educate. And so he has a very, I think, interesting understanding of why there is that distinction. And then we're going to hopefully have a few minutes for questions. Okay. They ask, why does it say obligated in regards to lulav and tzitzit? And here it says his father gets for him, right? Why does it not say he is liable, right? Really should say obligated in tefillin, right? Why is there this shift in the language? Why is the father sometimes present in some of the mitzvot? And why is the father sometimes not present in some of the mitzvot? And it seems to me that it chose the language of obligated for lulav and tzitzit because any person who sees him, right, that is this little kid, will give the kid his lulav to wave as a loan, or will give him tzitzit to wrap himself in temporarily, right? Where the Yehoyada is saying, actually, the kid needs to do these mitzvot. The kid doesn't have any money, right? The kid isn't big enough to go harvesting a lulav. So there is just an assumption, right, that the way that the child is going to get their obligation fulfilled, which he's considering an obligation on the child, right, is they're going to go to shul. They're going to ask, hey, you know, Mr. Goldsmith, can I use your tzitzit? You know, hey, Barbara, can I borrow your lulav? And people are just going to let them do it, right? Because anyone who sees him, right, that has seized the kid, will be able to estimate based on their height and based on their appearance that they've gotten to the age where they need to be educated in these mitzvot and will certainly enable them to fill these mitzvot, at least temporarily, right? What adult is not going to let this kid who seems fairly competent borrow his lulav? We'll all allow it. And therefore, right, the Ben Yehoyada is saying this brayta, right, this text reflects a reality where the whole community, any adult that is around, is going to understand that I don't know if we would say it's their obligation, but like it's perfectly reasonable for them to be expected to let this kid borrow their lulav, let this kid borrow their tallit. Okay. But for tefillin, which require a clean body, even though one who sees him, right, that is the adult that's looking at the kid, can guess that they've gotten to an appropriate age to be educated in the mitzvah of tefillin, no one is going to enable them to fulfill the mitzvah by giving them tefillin to lay temporarily as a loan, the way one would for an adult who is obligated, because maybe this one, right, that is this kid, doesn't have a clean body and can't keep themselves from passing gas. That's basically the minimum standard for laying tefillin. You need to be able to like control your bodily functions. So only his father, who lives with him and knows his nature and his behavior, if he knows that he is appropriate for this, he must buy him tefillin to educate him. This is extremely subtle and extremely important. Essentially, what the Ben Yehoyada is saying here is, why does the father have a special obligation to educate their children? There's nothing to do with the fact that they're the father and that there's some special mitzvah for the father. Actually, the child is required to educate themselves, or the community, right, at large is responsible to foster, right, the learning and the growth of the children. When we talk about the father in specific, it's because the father knows the kid, okay? And if you wanted to like push this to its like logical extension, if you have one of these scenarios where, God forbid, you have a deadbeat dad, okay? And the deadbeat dad doesn't know the kid, they would not be the one to get them the tefillin because they wouldn't know, okay? So the only reason why we're having the father be involved is because the father's the only one who we can trust to know whether or not the kid has, you know, the kind of bodily self-control that's necessary to lay the tefillin, right? We're only asking the father to step in because we cannot assume that the general community is going to step in. I'm perfectly happy to lend my tefillin to another person who's 25 years old. I'm not going to lend my tefillin to a 9-year-old. I don't know. I don't know if I can trust them. Okay. And similarly with learning a verse from the Torah, which is from the point that he can speak it, right? The point at which the child is obligated is the point at which they can speak. Then we say the father teaches them Torah, because at that time, right, when the child is still really small, they are kept inside the house and there's no one else there with them. And that's why it says that the father teaches them Torah, right? the reason why the father is being singled out here is because the father knows the child. Because the father knows the child, they know when this kid can actually understand. They know when this kid can actually control their bodily functions, right? But generally, right, the way that we are going to think about it, according to the Ben Yehoyada, is this is about the child, right? The child has an obligation. That obligation then ends up impacting all the adults around them, all of the adults around them. We as a community have a responsibility when we see a child starting to learn to support them. And that obligation is not relatives. That obligation is not the Beit Din, the court, and the leadership. That obligation is any adult nearby who can help. We are all responsible to support this child's development. And when the Braita goes out of its way to talk about the father is not the father qua the father. It's not about DNA, right? Or about adoptive parents. It is about, do you know this child? Are you able to understand what they understand? Okay, and so the person who knows the child the best, they are the one who is going to be called upon to educate them, right? And I think this also says something really powerful about education. Education is about knowing the kid. It's not like the person who's most knowledgeable about mitzvot is the one who is obligated to educate the child. It's the person who's most knowledgeable about the child who is obligated to educate the child, which I think is just a really important thing to understand about education. It's true about adults too, right? But it's certainly true about children, right? That educating a child is not about the material. They're going to forget it. It's not really what it's about, right? Educating a child is about connecting with the child, connecting the child to the Torah, right? And the person who is best suited to do that is not necessarily going to be the greatest expert. It's going to be the person who has an understanding of the child and an investment in the process. Okay, before we open up for questions, I just wanted to bring in Maimonides again, because he's going to be our constant. And he says, anyone who is obligated in the shofar and in the sukkah is obligated in taking the lulav. And anyone who is exempt from shofar and sukkah is exempt from the lulav. Right? So he doesn't use the standard of can waive. Okay? He's basically saying there is a standard of obligation and it follows through all of these types of mitzvot. But a minor who knows how to waive is obligated in the lulav from the words of the scribes in order to educate him in mitzvot, right? The language of Rashi and the language of the Rambam elsewhere, right, repeats himself. Even though this is not the plain sense of the text, the Rambam comes in and says, it's only obligated rabbinically and it's only for the sake of education. Okay, so I'm gonna stop my share. I'll take a few moments if there are any questions or thoughts.
Thoughts?
Sure. You want to share a thought?
I do. Actually, I have like a 9-mile list. Anybody, I don't see everybody's face or anything. Is anybody else over 60 out there?
We often have older adults participating in our classes. You're not alone.
Great. Well, I'm 74, and that's just to set, you know, the stage for how I was raised, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe some of you can sympathize or empathize with whatever. And I have absolutely no quarrel with the way my parents raised me, none whatsoever. Anyway, the thing about giving a child a moment to not do some kind of obligation, they're playing a game or whatever, or it's time to eat right now because it's 6 o'clock, dad's home, and it's the only time we're ever going to see each other. Bring your friend to the table if you have to, but we're starting right now. We're not going to sit around and wait for you. And the little anecdote that I wanted to tell, I have two little anecdotes. Stop me if you get bored. But
choose one because we only have 2 more minutes.
Okay, I'm not going to do that one. I'm going to do something else. I started a synagogue here in Spain. I've lived here for 36 years. There should be Valencia, Spain there, but it's not. I'll stick it next time. But over the last 28 years, I have run Sinagoga La Javura here in Valencia, Spain. And every year, the time around Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Pesach, I get calls from parents from England, from Germany, from France, all saying, my daughter or my son is going to be in Spain. And good for them, but I could care less. The parent calls me and they want me to be their mother away from home for their kid. And over the years, I have learned to tell the parent, if give them my phone number, if the kid needs help, they can call me if they want to. I've had, I don't know how many, I've lost count of parents that have called me and not one single kid has ever called me. I would like to know when a parent is supposed to grow up. You know, there's a certain amount of time here where you have had your go at the problem. The problem leaves home, whether it's a good problem or a negative problem, they go away and, you know, it's bye, I'll see you later. Because when the parent calls, they have a problem with cutting the umbilical cord. And it's the kid who would die before they would call me.
Well, and to respond to the question embedded in the anecdote, right? I think part of what's going on here in these texts is we're also training children to take responsibility for their own behavior, right? At later texts are saying it's the obligation of the parents, but the plain sense of the text is, as soon as my child knows this is food and this is not food, they also have to understand they have to come to the table, right? And I think that there is, the more we make the conversation about the kids and the less we make the conversation about the parents, even making it the responsibility of the community and not the parents, I think goes in the direction that you are suggesting, which is part of education is training children to understand that their education is their own responsibility, right? And that their behavior is their own responsibility. How much we can change the culture around helicopter parents, that's not the topic of this class. But I think that you're right, that part of what these, as early as possible, right, stages are, as soon as this kid is 4, as soon as this kid is 5, they are going to be obligated. Part of what that accomplishes is it trains the child to feel responsible for themselves at the earliest possible stage.
You know, I might be ignorant, but is Ben Yehoyada one of the Amoraim, or is it a separate book?
No. Much, much later. He's 18th century.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we are going to close here. Thanks for sticking with us. And our last session is tomorrow. So hope to see you then.